Welcome back to the Deep Dive. So we have a really interesting stack of documents on the table today.
Yeah, a bit of a departure for us.
It is. Usually, you know, we're tearing apart a business book or maybe some complex scientific study on, I don't know, sleep or nutrition.
Right.
But today, we're doing something a little different. We're looking at a person.
It is a bit of a departure, but I think a really necessary one, especially given the state of the job market right now.
Absolutely. So specifically, we're looking at the professional footprint of a senior creative designer named J.R. Cambo.
Okay.
We've got a comprehensive resume. It's dated 2026. So this is, you know, cutting edge, a LinkedIn profile, and his personal portfolio site, jj-design.com. And I have to say, just looking at all this, my first thought was just, wow, the definition of the word designer has changed so much.
Oh, it's almost unrecognizable compared to even 5 or 10 years ago. And that's really the mission for this deep dive. We aren't here to, grade Jay's resume. We're not recruiters. We're using him as a lens, a case study, really, to unpack what a modern, high-level creative professional actually looks like in 2026.
A case study.
Because, as we're going to see, this isn't just about making things look pretty anymore.
No, not at all.
It's a case study on adapting to technology, specifically artificial intelligence, driving serious revenue, and just maintaining a career that spans over 20 years in a digital landscape that shifts under our feet every 6 months.
Survival really feels like the right word there. You look at the tech landscape, it's chaotic.
It is.
And that leads me right to the hook that jumped out at me in the very first section of his profile. I think this is going to surprise a lot of
We're
people.
in the skills section.
Exactly. There's this prevailing narrative, especially in creative fields, that we should be terrified of AI.
Oh, yeah, the robots are coming for our jobs.
Exactly. That they're coming for the art jobs and the writers. But Jay lists AI and efficiency right at the top of his executive summary. He isn't hiding from it.
That stood out to me immediately.
He is explicitly listing tools like Claude, Gemini, and ChatGPT right next to his traditional design tools.
Yeah.
And he says he uses them to accelerate the UX life cycle.
And that phrase right there is a massive signal.
It feels like a very bold move for a
It
creative.
is. It flips the narrative from, AI will replace me to AI empowers me. It signals a shift from the designer as a creator of assets,
Someone who just draws the pictures.
right, to the designer as an architect of solutions. When he talks about using these tools to accelerate the life cycle, he is speaking a language that business leaders really want to hear. He's talking about speed and efficiency.
Okay, so let's dig into that because accelerating the life cycle sounds great in a boardroom, but what does it actually mean in practice? And we see this most clearly in his recent role at Follett Software.
Right. So let's look at the timeline. He's been at Follett Software LLC from November 2012 all the way through October 2025.
It's a 13-year tenure, which is an eternity in tech.
It really is. I mean, in an industry where people jump ship every 18 months, staying somewhere for 13 years suggests you aren't just surviving, you are evolving with the company.
And right under that experience, he has this specific bullet point, AI-driven prototyping. It says he accelerated the design life cycle for Master Library Suite by integrating Claude, Gemini, and ChatGPT with Figma. So for the listener who might not be a professional designer, can we just break down what that actually looks like? What is Figma?
So Figma is a like the industry standard tool for interface design. It's essentially a collaborative whiteboard where you draw the buttons, you lay out the screens, and you decide how an app looks and feels.
Got it.
But here's the bottleneck in that process. Usually you draw a box, and then you have to figure out what text goes in the box. You have to write a user scenario. You have to figure out the logic of, if I click this, what happened?
Right, and that takes time. You're just sitting there blinking at a cursor.
Huge amounts of time. By integrating large language models like Claude or Gemini, Jay is likely automating that context.
How so?
He's probably saying to the AI, generate realistic library book data for this table, or write me a user flow for a librarian checking out a book who has an overdue fine.
Ah, so he isn't using AI to make the art. He's using it to clear the road.
Precisely. He is removing the blank page problem. He's generating the filler, the logic, maybe even some of the code snippets for the prototype so he can focus on the high-level architecture.
So it turns what might be a 1 week prototyping phase into what, 1 day phase.
Exactly.
And when you're working on something the scale of Follett, that speed matters. I looked up the context here. Follett is not a small shop.
No.
The resume notes that he led the UI redesign for Follett Destiny, which is a flagship platform for a $2.7 billion K-12 education provider.
And that scale just changes the stakes completely. When you're dealing with a $2.7 billion ecosystem, you can't just move fast and break things like the old Facebook motto.
Right. If you break the library system for 10,000 schools, you have a massive problem.
A huge problem.
So how does the AI help there? I mean, wouldn't using AI be riskier?
Well, actually, in this context, it de-risks the process because he can prototype faster, he can test more ideas.
Okay.
He can fail 5 times in the simulator using AI to generate all those user scenarios before they write a single line of expensive production code. He's saving the company money by failing cheaply in the design phase, not expensively in the build phase.
That's a crucial distinction. He isn't just a creative, he's an efficiency strategist.
Mm-hmm.
But this brings up a tension I want to explore. If you've been in the game for 20 years, I mean, his resume starts back in 2001, it takes a certain mindset to embrace tools that, frankly, threaten the way you used to work.
It does. A lot of designers from the early 2000s are resisting this. They want to protect the craft of doing it all by hand.
Yeah.
Jay's profile suggests he cares more about the outcome than the process. He's layering the new the AI on top of the fundamental wisdom he's built over 2 decades.
Speaking of outcomes, let's pivot to the other thing that makes this profile stand out.
The numbers.
The numbers. Usually when I look at a creative resume, it's all very qualitative, passionate about color theory, evocative storytelling, that sort of thing.
Right.
Which is fine. But Jay's resume reads like a sales ledger.
It's full of hard numbers.
It's startlingly specific. He literally calls himself a revenue generator.
I love that phrasing. It's aggressive, but in this market, it's necessary.
So let's look at the receipts here. We have to go back a bit to his independent contractor phase under Jay Design. He lists work for Zorro Tools, which is a subsidiary of W.W. Grainger.
Grainger's a massive industrial supply company. We're talking nuts, bolts, safety gear. It's not exactly sexy design work.
No, but listen to this stat. Engineered targeted email campaigns based on purchase data, securing sales of over $270,000 within just 8 months.
And that is the difference between decorating and designing.
How so?
Well, a decorator would ask, does this email look nice? Is the blue the right shade? Jay asked, what does the data say these people buy?
It implies he was digging into the spreadsheets.
Exactly. To get a result like $270,000, you have to understand customer segmentation. You have to look at purchase history. He likely designed the email hierarchy to trigger a specific psychological response based on that data.
He tied his pixel pushing directly to the bank account.
He did. And it isn't a one-off. Go back even further to his time at Quillcore, which is Staples, from 2001 to 2005,
right.
He claims he increased conversion rates by nearly 20% in 1 year and generated 1.5 million in new unique sales through landing pages.
A 20% lift in conversion for a company like Staples is enormous.
It's huge. We're talking about moving the needle on millions of users.
So here's my question. How does a creative designer actually do that? Is it just making the buy button bigger?
Sometimes it is, but usually it's about reducing friction. It's about managing ad hierarchies, which he specifically mentions in that section.
Ad hierarchies.
Yeah. Hierarchy in design isn't just about what's biggest. It's about guiding the eye. When a user lands on a page, where do they look first? Where do they look second? If they get confused, they leave. Jay is using design to just grease the slide toward the purchase.
So he's basically quantified the value of good design.
Which is the hardest thing for creatives to do. If you can walk into a meeting with a VP of sales or a CFO and say, my design made you $1.5 million, you are bulletproof.
Yeah.
You're not asking for permission to make it pretty anymore. You are a strategic partner explaining how you're going to make the money.
Look at his time at CCH, Wolters Kluwer. That's in the high-stakes financial impact section.
Right. He spearheaded the design of user conference platforms that generated annual revenues exceeding $5 million.
$5 million.
Again, he connects his output, the platform design, to the ultimate outcome, the revenue. He keeps score.
Okay, so we have the AI-powered efficiency, and we have the hard-nosed revenue generation. But I want to shift gears to something that feels a little less Wolf of Wall Street and more, I don't know, technical and grounded in the user's reality.
You're talking about the compliance work.
Yeah. Under his Follett experience, he lists accessibility and compliance, and he throws some serious alphabet soup at us. WCAG, ADE, AAA.
This is incredibly important, and honestly, it's where a lot of pretty design just falls apart.
For the uninitiated, let's define this. What is WCAG?
It stands for Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. It's the international standard for making the web accessible to people with disabilities.
And the AA and AAA.
Those are the strictness levels. So we're talking about ensuring that someone who is blind and uses a screen reader can actually navigate the site. Someone who can't use a mouse and only uses a keyboard. Someone who is colorblind and can't distinguish between a green go button and a red stop button.
And he says he partnered with QA teams to guarantee all handoffs met these standards.
Yeah.
In the context of K-12 education, I have to imagine this is not optional.
It is absolutely not optional. If a public school buys software, it must be accessible to every student.
Right.
If a blind student can't access their homework portal because the designer didn't tag the images correctly, that's a civil rights violation. It's a lawsuit waiting to happen, and more importantly, it's a failure of the product's mission.
So Jay isn't just making it look cool. He's basically doing risk management.
He is. And think about the difficulty level here. He mentions working on a course scheduler project valued at $1.2 million. Have you ever seen the back-end logic of a school schedule?
It sounds like a complete nightmare. You've got thousands of students, limited rooms, specific teacher schedules, prerequisites, time slots.
It's a logic puzzle from hell. Now imagine taking that back-end chaos and making it simple enough for a stressed-out administrator to use and making it fully compliant for a user with disabilities.
He calls it balancing complex business logic with intuitive user requirements.
That is the senior UX designer. A junior designer can make a simple thing look good. A senior designer can make a complex thing feel simple.
That's a great way to put it.
It's the ability to hold two opposing forces, chaos and order, in your head at the same time.
It really highlights that unicorn skill set we hear about, the designer who can do it all. And looking at the notable skills section, he really is blurring the lines between design and engineering.
The front-end development section catches my eye immediately.
Yeah, he lists responsive HTML5, CSS3, JavaScript.
And he specifies production-ready. That is a bold claim.
What's the difference between, you know, knowing HTML and being production-ready?
Knowing HTML means you can tweak a headline or change a color on your MySpace page back in the day. Production-ready means you can write code that can go live on the server without an engineer having to rewrite it from scratch. It means he speaks the language of the developers.
That must change the dynamic on a team completely.
It does. The biggest friction point in tech is usually that handoff between design and engineering.
Right.
Designers draw impossible things. Engineers say, we can't build that, or that will take 6 months. Jay bridges that gap. He's not just handing over a picture of a website. He's handing over the blueprints.
But then, just when you think, okay, he's a technical guy, a numbers guy, a code guy, you look at the soft skills.
Right.
He calls himself a communication guru.
Devoted collaborator who prioritizes and places business connections high.
It's a little bit of corporate speak, but it feels intentional.
It tells me he understands that soft skills are actually hard skills. You can have the best code and the best design in the world, but if you can't sell your ideas to the product manager, or if you're difficult to work with, you're dead in the water.
And I found a little Easter egg in the additional experience section that might explain why he claims to be good at communication.
Oh, yeah.
Did you catch the teaching gig?
The Wheaton College position, yeah.
A Vashon professor.
Yeah.
Created curriculum and instructed 200-level graphic design courses.
That makes perfect sense.
You think that translates to the corporate world?
100%. If you can explain the abstract principles of typography or user flow to a room full of distracted 20-year-old college students, explaining a UI change to a CEO is a piece of cake.
That's a good point.
Teaching forces you to articulate the why. You can't just say, because it looks good. You have to explain the theory behind it.
It really rounds out the profile. He have the technical chops, the business savvy, and the mentorship ability.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one more piece of his education I want to flag. He has a BFA in graphic design from Iowa State, which, you know, we expect. Mm. But he also has a minor in English.
Ah, the English minor. That is the secret weapon.
Really? In a visual field?
Absolutely. Design is communication.
Mm.
But more specifically, modern UX is largely about text. It's the words on the buttons, the instructions, the error messages. We call it microcopy.
So being able to write helps him design.
It means he doesn't have to fill his designs with lorem ipsum dummy text. He can write the actual message. If you look at his resume, he mentions collaborating with Marcom Team's marketing communications.
Right.
Being able to write means he can control the narrative of the product. He's not just designing the box. He is designing the message inside the box.
It's a holistic stack. The English minor helps the communication, the teaching helps the leadership, the code helps the execution, and the AI speeds it all up.
It's a very formidable combination.
I want to zoom out a bit and look at the structure of his career again. We talked about his long stint at Fall at 13 years, but before that, and even overlapping with that, he had this independent hustle going on, JA Design.
Right, the 2010 to 2012 era, mostly, but it seems like he kept the entity alive for contract work throughout his career.
The client list is impressive. Mm-hmm. Discover Card, Visa, GE Capital, Orbitz Worldwide. I mean, these are heavy hitters.
They are. And notice the pattern in the work he did for them. Delivered branding standards and design systems.
Systems is the word that keeps coming up.
Yeah. Whether he's working for himself with these giant corporate clients or working inside Follett, he's always building systems. He isn't just making one-off artifacts. He's creating the rules, the centralized libraries, the standards that ensure consistency.
Order out of chaos.
Exactly. When you work with a brand like Visa or GE, you can't have five different shades of blue or three different fonts. The brand is the asset. Jay clearly specializes in creating the infrastructure that protects that asset.
It is fascinating to compare that independent hustle mode with the corporate leadership mode.
Yeah.
In one, he's the gun for hire solving a specific revenue problem, like the Zorro Tools email campaign. In the other, at Follett, he's the long-term guardian of the product ecosystem.
And that duality is probably what has kept him relevant for nearly 25 years.
Yeah.
He has the agility of a freelancer, that hunger to drive numbers, but also the patience and strategic vision of a corporate leader who can steer a product for a decade.
So when we step back and look at this profile, Jay Archambault, senior creative designer, class of 2026, what is the big takeaway here? Because to me, he seems like a survivor. Mm-hmm. He survived the dot-com era, the mobile revolution, and now the AI revolution.
I wouldn't just say survivor. I would say he's the prototype for the generalist expert.
Break that down. Generalist expert sounds like an oxymoron.
Well, look at the trajectory. He started in 2001 at Quill doing ad design and landing pages. Very tactical, very hands-on.
Okay.
Then he moved to CCH and became a manager, overseeing teams and video shoots. Then he went independent and became a system builder for big brands. And finally, at Follett, he became a product strategist and an AI pilot.
He never stayed in one box.
Right. If he had just stayed a graphic designer making print ads, he would have been obsolete 10 years ago. Longevity comes from evolution. He moved from print to web, from web to UX, from UX to front-end code, and now from manual design to AI-augmented prototyping.
It's a powerful lesson. Mm. The tools change. Figma, HTML, ChatGPT. Okay. But the core skill is just solving business problems.
And measuring the results. That's the other pillar. He never lost sight of the fact that design is a business function. Whether it was the $270K for Zorro or the $5 million for CCH, he kept score.
I love that. He kept score. It forces you to be honest about your impact.
It does. And it forces the company to value you properly.
So we're looking at a relationship-driven AI-empowered designer who speaks code, teaches students, and measures success in millions of dollars. It's a high bar for anyone listening who wants to break into this field or even just stay relevant in it.
It is, but it's an achievable one if you stay curious. That's the thread connecting it all. Curiosity. He never stopped learning the new tool.
And that brings us to the end of this deep dive. But before we go, I want to leave you with a thought. We started this episode talking about how Jay lists Claude, Gemini, and ChatGPT as tools for efficiency.
Right.
He's a veteran with 2 decades of experience, and he is still looking for shortcuts to get to the good work faster.
It raises a really important question for everyone listening, regardless of your industry.
That's exactly. If a designer with that much experience is using AI to accelerate his workflow, what tool are you ignoring right now because you think it's cheating or not the way we do things?
Mm.
What part of your life cycle could be sped up if you just let the robots handle the boring stuff?
Are you protecting your process or are you protecting your outcome? Jay clearly chose the outcome.
Something to mull over as you head back to your own workflow. Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.
Goodbye, everyone.